Hello, everyone. I am Tom Praviti.
And I'm Emily Swaddle.
And welcome back to the Carbon Removal Show.
Welcome back, listeners. Today's episode is a little bit different to normal. Last time you joined us at the UK GGR event hosted by Core. This time, as promised, we'll be sharing with you a very special live public event that took place at the conference and was hosted by the one and only Tom Praviti of the Carbon Removal Show. Round of applause for Tom Praviti.
I don't do autographs, in case anyone's interested. But we do selfies. Yeah, that is right. While most of the UK GGR event was targeted at specialists and those who work in or research greenhouse gas removal, this one was open to pretty much anyone who wanted to just be involved. The conversation was so interesting and so valuable that we were just keen to share it here pretty much in its entirety for you all.
The event was called Greenhouse Gas Removal, Getting It Right for People and Planet. And as the title suggests, it looked especially at questions of equity and public engagement. These are not unfamiliar topics for us at the Carbon Removal Show, but rarely have we had the chance to dive so deep into this side of the carbon removal conversation, supported by such a knowledgeable panel. So it's really exciting. Our previous two episodes teed us up really nicely for this debate. Some of the points raised so far this season form the foundation of this whole conversation at this event.
Yeah. And you've just said it, Emily, but the panel was so impressive. I was joined on stage by three people: Dr. Rob Bellamy, who's a lecturer in climate and society at the University of Manchester, and also the lead on responsible innovation at the Core Hub. We also had Dr. Amira Sawas, who's the program and research director at Climate Outreach, and Dr. Nem Vaughan, an associate professor in climate change at the University of East Anglia. Nem, as some of you may remember, also featured in season one of the Carbon Removal Show, so it was great to speak with her again. The event was attended by both an in-person audience, as well as an even larger online audience. Those that were online could tune in via the live stream, they could answer polling questions, contribute to word clouds, and also pose questions to panelists.
Nem Vaughan kicked the conversation off with a quick overview of some of the techniques and technologies currently being deployed and developed in the GGR space. Even if you're already super familiar with these, which I'm sure you all are because you've listened to season one of the Carbon Removal Show 7 times, it's a really useful and pretty concise refresher. After this, the group dives into some much thornier questions, getting into the juicy stuff. And you'll hear about 45 minutes of discussion in all, after which Tom and I will jump back in for some quick reflections at the end of the episode.
It's also worth noting that this conversation was in May of 2022, so one or two of the political references may already feel a bit out of date.
Tom, you're not supposed to reveal the inner workings of the podcast world. The listeners are supposed to believe that you are currently live from Embankment, or at least on your way there at this very moment, so that you can be live any second.
Oh, that's not how editing works, though. But yeah, fine. All right, fine. I'll get my skates on and probably a bit of a trek, considering I'm in Lisbon right now. But I'll see if I can make it there in time.
Giving away all of our secrets. All right, I tell you what, in order to give you time to get from Lisbon to the Embankment, let's play a short message to give you time to get there. This podcast is brought to you in part by Patch. Patch is the platform that powers climate action and makes it easy for businesses of all sizes to neutralize a carbon footprint or contribute to vetted, high-quality carbon removal and avoidance projects. A perfect fit for this show, don't you think, Tom?
Totally. Patch enables companies in fintech, crypto, travel, shipping, e-commerce, and more to estimate the carbon emissions of specific transactions like shipping a package and embed carbon removal directly into their products or services to account for those emissions, all with just a few lines of code. That means businesses and their end customers can be more sustainable and participate in impactful climate actions through a trusted platform.
What's more, Patch also allows companies to make purchases of vetted carbon credits directly from their platform. They find the best project developers doing the hard work of carbon removal, and companies get access to all of them in just one click. Head to patch.io/TCRS to get free access to their platform.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Very happy to have you all here. Welcome, everyone that's online. I think we've got people tuning in from YouTube, the live page that we've got set up as well. Welcome to this event, which is titled Getting It Right for People and the Planet. So the first thing we're going to start with, Nem.
Certainly. So I was asked just to run through briefly the different types of greenhouse gas removal. So I'm not going to give you an exhaustive list, but I'll just go through some of the main ones. So these are methods to try and remove CO2 from the atmosphere and store them out of interaction with that atmosphere for a long time. So we can do that by increasing the amount of carbon in our vegetation, so in our trees, and also in our soils. So this might mean, for example, planting more woodlands and forests, involving more trees in our agricultural landscapes, in hedgerows or agroforestry, and different changes to the way that we farm our land, particularly in the UK or elsewhere, that means we're putting more carbon into the soils. So they're often sometimes called nature-based, which Rob will get a bit touchy about in a minute. But they can sometimes be grouped together like that. So you've got your more trees, more carbon in the soil. We can try and speed up a process that takes place naturally to remove CO2 out of the air, and that is weathering. So this is the process of the interaction between rainwater and rocks that very gradually over a long time will take CO2 out of the atmosphere and actually put it in our deep oceans. And so some people here today are looking at ways to speed that process up. It's called enhanced weathering. And then we've got two others that both have a similar kind of end point in terms of where they're trying to store this carbon. That is, now sorry for the acronyms and the long names, but biomass energy with carbon capture and storage and direct air capture with carbon capture and storage. So you can see that the carbon capture and storage bit is the same. So with biomass energy, carbon capture and storage, what we might do is grow new biomass or use agricultural or forestry waste products, like leftover things, and use that in some kind of way to generate some energy, for example, some electricity or a transport fuel, or maybe make some hydrogen, lots of different ideas there. But crucially, when you make that, rather than allowing the CO2 from combusting or fermenting that biomass to go to the atmosphere like it would ordinarily, you capture that CO2 and then you actually compress it, you transport it and store it deep underground, about a kilometre down in, for example, old oil and gas wells or other structures underground called saline aquifers, which have the kind of spaces in them that are currently filled with salt water that you push out and put the CO2 in. And that's kept down there for a long time because over the top of that feature is a cap rock, which doesn't let the CO2 come out. And the final one, which is related because the last part of the process is the same, is direct air capture. So rather than growing biomass or getting some electricity out of it, you just essentially scrub directly from the atmosphere CO2 out and then compress it and store it. So there are some other ideas as well. There's other particular ways of getting carbon into the soil like biochar. There's also ideas to try and increase the amount of carbon that goes into the seas in coastal environments or out in the open ocean. But they're the kind of main ones. So you can see some of them are trying to speed up natural processes that take place. Some of them are trying to create new ways of taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. All of them, what's important is that CO2 stays locked up for a long time, and that will help contribute towards net zero.
Wow. Okay. I think that was in less than 5 minutes as well. That was incredibly fast. So something that we'd like to kind of go into next, again, everyone with your QR codes at the ready, hope you're all on Slido. What's the biggest concern that you might have about greenhouse gas removal? So we'll see what's coming up. What's coming up? We've got permanence.
Wrong use of land, that implies as a right use. Greenwash, it won't work, it's not working. So that's interesting given that a number of those technologies I just ran through don't really fully exist yet. They're still at like research and development stage.
Amir, Rob, any thoughts on
greenwashing?
What's happening so far?
Yeah, greenwashing is a big concern.
Yep.
Justice, MRV in green.
So just for the audience at home then, MRV is monitoring, reporting and verification. I've sometimes seen slightly other words, but it's about the idea of being able to know that the carbon you've stored has actually been stored. There's a contrast here, speed of implementation versus is it too late, which I thought was interesting, right? So there's a tension there between some people thinking that it's going too quickly and others thinking it's not going fast enough in some regard. Mm-hmm.
What it feels like at this point, in some of these points that people are making out, is that there is a question about the projects that we have, but it feels through some of this that perhaps it's not necessarily an if we should use this, it's more of a how we use this best. Do you guys agree with that or disagree?
Depends who you ask, I think. I mean, this has been a debate for a while, and there's communities and constituencies who think that we shouldn't rely on these technologies because they're unproven.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that's where I sit, but we have to acknowledge that.
A totally valid point. Well, Rob, why don't we start with you then?
Yeah.
Your thoughts on this, the work cloud, but also more importantly, the bigger topic that we're talking about here.
Yeah, yeah. I was just looking at how Boris Johnson's one of the biggest concerns. I can understand that. Okay, so yeah, we've heard from them then about the range of options that are kind of on the table. We also know why we're kind of here considering greenhouse gas removal in the first place. To counteract residual emissions, the things that we, you know, the amounts of emissions that we can't get rid of from sectors like aviation, shipping, and agriculture. But we also know that people have lots of concerns about greenhouse gas removal, whether it's kind of land use change, Boris Johnson, or the risk that it might deter mitigation or emissions reductions. So what do we do when we've got a situation where we need to do something, but it also raises a lot of concerns? Well, we need to do it, but we need to do it responsibly. And that's what I'm really interested in this project that we're involved in, is responsible innovation or responsible incentivization even. So how can we do these things in a way that is responsible? So what is responsible innovation? It's got four dimensions. Firstly, it's about anticipating the possible impacts that might arise from, in this case, greenhouse gas removal. It's about anticipating or reflecting on the uncertainties and assumptions that we as scientists and innovators are making. And believe me, there are a lot of them. Thirdly, it's about engaging society. So events like this are really, really important. And then finally, it's about being able to change the trajectory of the innovation itself in response to the intelligence that we develop on those former three things. So I just want to talk a little bit more about the societal engagement aspect in a little bit more detail. I think we need societal input in three key areas. So we know we need to do some kind of carbon removal, but we don't necessarily know what kinds of carbon removal yet. And we need societal input in choosing and evaluating which carbon removals we might want to take forward. There are lots of options on the table, as Nem's already described, but we might not want to take all of them forward, for various reasons that have come up in the concerns, for example. Secondly, we need input on how to bring these things forward. So what are the kind of policy incentives that we might like to use? And then thirdly, we need input on designing governance architectures for these things as well. How might we control them if they actually come into to be realized? So just on the first point about choosing which ones we might want to go with, we already know a little bit about, or quite a lot actually, about how the public thinks about carbon removal. So Nem warned you a little bit about this. So one thing we know from public engagement exercises on carbon removal is that people tend to prefer natural interventions. So we often see things like afforestation, biochar, or peatland restoration doing really well in public appraisals of these things. But the trouble is that underneath the hood, underneath this kind of natural framing, there's a lot of other stuff going on. So one of the things that I'm quite keen to do is kind of get past that kind of top-level framing and start scrutinizing these proposals in more detail. So what are the specific qualities of these things that we might want to think about in terms of effectiveness, ethics, various other things? And going beyond this kind of high-level idea of nature equals good. I mean, who's against nature? Nobody. So let's start talking about the details. Secondly, input on policy instruments. We know that the way in which we bring these things forward will have a big impact on public opinion. It's not just about focusing on the physical objects of the technologies. So we know, for example, that in relation to BECCS, or bioenergy with CCS, one of the technologies that Nem mentioned, we know that if you kind of think about bringing that forward using the same policy instruments that have been applied to nuclear energy, then it's very likely to lead to a public backlash because of the spiraling costs associated with that particular policy. So we really need to think about the social bit of the socio-technical systems that are carbon removal. And then finally, on governance, we already know that people are concerned about transparency, about minimizing and monitoring impacts, about oversight or ideally independence from private interests, developing technology-specific protocols. And then finally, I think there's a new question that's starting to emerge around climate justice as well, and the way in which carbon removal might be used actually to help climate justice. So maybe the developed world, for example, should be doing carbon removal or have a kind of more of a reason to do it in order to allow some developing countries to spend a bit more on their kind of greenhouse gas emissions in order to develop. So these are just a few of the things that we're interested in on responsible innovation, societal engagement in the Greenhouse Gas Removal Hub. But this is just the beginning of a conversation, so I turn it over to you guys. What do you think?
That's really useful. Thank you so much for that context, Rob. Speaking on the kind of social aspects of this. It'd be really interesting, Amira, to hear from you actually on a bit more around kind of how can we make this more of an inclusive, diverse discussion.
Thanks. Okay, so I work for an organisation called Climate Outreach, and we do research with general publics in different countries. We've done a lot in the UK, and we're sort of constantly doing nationally representative sample research with different people to understand how they respond to climate change and climate messages. So, you know, I think I'm glad to be here because even though my background is at times has been in a more activist kind of space that where there is resistance to this whole notion, I do think we sort of need to move forward somehow in order for us to actually reach our sort of net zero or 1.5 degrees or even 2 degree transition. But can we actually set an inclusive vision for this? And if we can, how? I'm not sure, but what I can do is share what we know at the moment. So we know that people really care about climate change and they're very concerned. So polls consistently show that 70 to 80% of people say that they're very concerned about climate change in the UK, but also in many other contexts. And in the UK, we've sort of segmented the population. So we had a study called Britain Talks Climate, where we segmented people according to how they respond to climate messages. And a lot of that is actually sits with what their sort of deep values and identity issues. It's not as simple as, you know, left versus right of the political spectrum, for example. And there are some narratives that really don't work for people and put them off. So I'm very sad to say, as someone with a climate justice background, that at the moment in the UK, the term climate justice doesn't resonate with the majority of people. But what does resonate is talking about harm to nature, as we just heard, and also negative impacts on the lives of future generations. So there is a way to bring people on a journey, but there is a sort of need to sort of tailor narratives effectively that reach across society. But one thing I do have to really underscore, and this has just been kind of proven time and time again in our research, is that the majority of people, let's just take the UK here, have no idea what net zero is, let alone what I'm going to call GGR. They know that the government's responding to climate change, but they're largely unengaged with the what and the how. And I think we have to face that. We're not doing enough to engage people. And when we ask people about specific climate policies, on the whole, they don't feel engaged and they don't feel represented. So we recently, just a couple of months ago, did a survey where we asked people which political party has the best climate policies, and at least 50% said none or I don't know. And, you know, there wasn't much helpful in the rest of that sample, to be honest. So we need to really think about this. We need to understand people's hopes and fears about the future, because a lot of the response is rooted in that. And that requires a level of empathy, which hasn't really been shown by the climate sector in some ways. So it's almost a kind of judgment of people's resistance to change. And we have to understand, why do people resist change? And how do you take people on a journey where they feel like it's something that makes sense to them and they're actually going to take action in their own lives as well as with regards to their sort of voting preferences. We also need to talk about fairness. So what we know, I sort of mentioned that the justice term sometimes puts a lot of people on edge, although, again, very hard for me to say that as someone who cares about it. But fairness works, and fairness is important for everyone, and this is a globally studied phenomena, regardless of people's background. There's a need to feel a sense of fairness in how policies and solutions are created and implemented. But as we know from a recent study we've just done, which we're about to publish, fairness means very different things to many people. There is no one-size-fits-all approach to that, so we simply cannot assume that we know what people are going to think is fair. For some people, it involves addressing structural inequalities, so the climate justice mode, and redressing the burdens faced by some communities over others. For others, it means everyone being treated the same, and you can't always predict who's going to think what. So we have to be really careful about deciding for people what we think that how they're going to respond. But there are sort of three cluster considerations I had in mind when I was preparing for this. I think the first thing that we have to be aware of is that many people are skeptical of big projects and big institutions. So mega projects do not really engender a sense of excitement necessarily about the future. There are concerns from many communities about what does a mega project mean, who benefits from it, you know, is there corruption involved, land issues, there's so many different factors. And we know from lots of studies that mega projects have not worked very well in many countries from a human rights perspective. Lots of people are getting displaced by them, people's livelihoods are being dispossessed, and that could happen here as well. So we need to think very carefully about this. Secondly, in order for people to engage, as I said, whatever is, you know, the project is, it needs to resonate with people's values and identity. So how can the average person connect with a GGR project? How can the project reach simultaneous goals around, let's say, well-being, economic growth, and a sense of local connection? We need to invest in that and understand it. We can't just kind of think that we know what people want to hear. The backlash issue is a very real one. The third thing is, and we see this time and time again, that you actually need something called trusted messengers. So you need people to communicate about projects, about transitions and journeys. And it needs to be people that make sense to different groups within society. So there are some people that can reach across society. And we know, for example, that David Attenborough performs very well across many groups, whereas, for example, Extinction Rebellion only seems to perform well with one of the groups that in the segmentation that we have. But actually what we know is that it really needs to be locally grounded people, that the sense of local is very, very important across the political spectrum, across different people. So who is it in the local space who can authentically communicate about the purpose of a big project, about how people can engage with it meaningfully? We need to connect with people in a way which feels appropriate, rooted, and not extractive. So we've heard about, you know, the importance of participation and assemblies and engagement, but often these are kind of ideas which come from a kind of extractive and exploitative mode of, oh, we'll just get them to agree. We'll do some presentations, we'll just get them to agree. No, we need to sit down, we need to hear what people think, we need to explore visions for the future. And we also need to restore and build trust with communities who have been and who feel continuously excluded by decision makers and by who they may see to be technocratic elites. So we do really need to cross over the divide from our space, which is currently this kind of, you know, science, elite, technocrat and activist debate about whether these, you know, technologies are going to work, and actually engage with people and give them something back for their engagement as well. People are busy, they have burdens, we need them to feel like they're part of it. So I'm going to stop there. There's so much that can be said on this topic, but I'm happy to have a discussion about it.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, everyone, individually for adding your touch on this. And we've got some great questions that have come in. So if it's anyone in the audience here or online, thank you very much for asking these. We're going to start turning to these questions now. Perhaps on what you already were kind of finishing up with, Amira, is perhaps, and for anyone on the panel here, maybe we could take one from Martin Lukak. What do you think is the key demographic to engage on greenhouse gas removal? Is there a key demographic that isn't being engaged with right now? Or yeah, it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts.
Well, I think the elephant in the room is youth. I think you know, that we've seen massive changes with in terms of engagement with climate change, with the rise of things like Fridays for Future and Extinction Rebellion, which has a considerable youth aspect to it. So I think that's the kind of implicit kind of demographic within that that question. But I think the key thing really with this is that we need to go kind of beyond demographics, I think, as well, to examine values and beliefs that people have that actually transcend those things. You know, my kind of approach to climate change is, you know, recognizing the fact that we disagree about how to tackle it, and we need to kind of come up with a way of being able to disagree in such a way that we actually still make progress, rather than kind of just saying, you know, it's this way or the highway. So it's about kind of trying to get to grips with those divergent values, I think. So that's my kind of thing.
Anything to add from either of yourselves?
I do have a thought, which is we have to stop thinking about what are the key demographics. Not to undermine the question, because I completely understand where it's coming from. We do have to think practically, but actually these are rooted solutions, so we need to look at the whole of society and you know, young people are engaged in climate change already. I have no concern about engaging young people. I have some concern about who are the young people getting involved in it. And it's, you know, there's probably an element of privilege in that, a privilege in space, having the time and space and facilitation to actually get involved. But yeah, what about the people who feel left behind? What about that? We have seen in other countries that policies have actually received such a big backlash that they've been reversed. I mean, Switzerland is a very good example of that. So I think what we need to do is consider it as a part, it's a development approach which can be implemented in certain areas in which everyone needs to be engaged, or everyone needs the opportunity. They can then choose, do I actually want to engage with this or not?
That's a really, really good point, Amira. And it feels as though greenhouse gas removal perhaps is more, I guess, the development of which is happening in more developed countries that have perhaps the time and the space to consider these more technical solutions as one example. And someone's put a good point here. I think it may be James Beard, if he's in the audience or online. Is greenhouse gas removal something developing countries are asking for from the developed countries in climate talks, or are they just more focused on adaptation, finance, loss and damage right now? Any comments, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so my perspective would be that that actually the conversation and the understanding around both net zero and therefore when you look at how to get to net zero, you start to understand that there are some emissions that we can't reduce by 2050, these hard to abate sectors that Rob mentioned. And so then you start to explore GGR. And I think for a number of countries, they're at a very different stage of that process. So I think, yes, there is currently much more focus still around loss and damage and financing for, you know, changing that pathway in terms of decarbonisation, reducing emissions. And so, you know, some of the work that we've done shows that it's mostly kind of European countries and more developed countries that have got to the stage of, you know, already with an emissions trajectory coming down, for example, you've started to think all the way through to the end of that 2050 time horizon, and then really thought in detail about the fact that there are these leftover emissions and they might need to do something about that. Whereas a number of other countries that are busy getting on with the job of, have still got quite a journey to go in terms of reducing their emissions. So I don't think it's part of something that's come up a few times in the kind of questions, but also in the word cloud about, I think very much across the panel and the kind of the people who've been here today are aware that the role GGR has in, you know, you've got to reduce your emissions first, and then there's some things that you can't reduce, so you need GGR available. So over time, we're going to increase the amount of carbon that's removed in order to be at that position in 2050, rather than some interpretations of GGR, which is like, great, I get to fly more and not feel guilty about it because I can just do one of those direct air capture things and then I'm fine, right? And so for those of us who work in this space and are familiar with the kind of scale of global and national emissions, we understand that and what's possible in terms of how much GGR could be done, we know that that's not an option. Whereas, you know, unless you've been through that level of kind of detail about it, then you might think, okay, great, so that's, I'm off the hook now, right? So I can do what I want, I can take my flight and not feel guilty. And that's come up, I think, in the word cloud, you recognise that as well, and it's come up a bit in these questions. And so, yeah, I think that's an important, it kind of reflects the stage. I think the conversation is dominated by more developed countries that are already on a path to decarbonisation and have had the time to kind of go through that process.
I think what I'm worried about is, which I've seen working internationally, is that some developed countries, big companies are testing their technologies in some of the most poor and disadvantaged regions of the world. They're going to, you know, to other countries that are seeking foreign direct investment, but then sort of using that leverage to then test out unproven technologies in ways which are actually harming already marginalised communities within those contexts. That worries me. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be tested, but that is, yeah, that's something that we need to ensure companies are accountable for.
I'm just looking at that related question about implementing CBR in the global south. And yeah, I think, there are kind of a couple of ways in which it could be implemented. One is with the global south kind of doing it themselves. And the other thing to consider is, yeah, the global north implementing it, but then through their supply chains actually kind of use, for example, using large areas of land in developing countries to then, for example, transport biomass or plant trees to offset their emissions in a different country. So there's a very clear kind of justice element to the kind of global north and south debate as well, I think.
Going into maybe another question then, something which has got quite a few likes from Ursula. How can I engage with greenhouse gas removal as an individual? And how can you help? Yeah, how can I help it grow the industry as a consumer? It does feel like a lot of the conversation, obviously, is around businesses interacting with these different approaches. Any thoughts?
So I would, I'll start us off. I think that with any of the ones that involve carbon capture and storage, that infrastructure to pipe and store CO2 does not exist today in the UK. So as an individual, as a consumer today, you can't influence that. We're at an earlier stage of the development. There's a range of things going on in terms of government and industries developing that. So right now, so that would push me more towards my thumb in terms of the list of the technologies I went through earlier, which would be around afforestation. Again, soil carbon as an individual, that might be harder to kind of make that direct connection. I think there are... So the tree planting activities or methods of storing more carbon in our soils, I think you can either plant a tree or maybe there are, I think there are a range of offset systems that you could choose to pay into, but I would definitely caution to look through their kind of how credible and what kind of things, factors they take into account in terms of this monitoring, verification and reporting that we had up earlier as a concern, so that you are able to trust that if they've said they've done some kind of GGR on your behalf for whatever sets of reasons, that that has is something that, you know, you don't just plant a tree and walk away. You'll tend to get a failure rate of, you know, success rate of like 1 tree in 3 if you do that. If they're small, you know, that these trees are still there, that they're protected, that someone's not going to come 10 years later and chop it down, that it's been done well. Also related to this point by John there around, you know, this fear, concern, and I can really see this, and not only we've just talked about Global South with land being used in the Global South, but you could imagine this happening in parts of less densely populated parts of the UK, in Wales or in Scotland, for example, where, you know, big tracts of land, as John's pointing out here, could be bought up and then people are selling off the carbon credits. So again, if you, Ursula, and those who've liked that question are interested, you know, looking through the kind of... what promises and, you know, that the company selling you those offsets has put in about communities and the benefits in, you know, who's making the kind of profit from this and who's benefiting, are the communities where these trees, for example, are being planted, are they the ones able to benefit? Does it fit with those agendas or not? So I'm afraid I wouldn't be able to recommend anything right now. You would really have to do, I feel like, quite a bit of research and digging around, not only about the carbon element, but about the communities and the social sustainability of those kind of promises, if you like. I think you could also, as an individual, get involved in your local community and think about, you know, there are various schemes to plant trees if you live in an urban area. In urban, most councils will have a scheme where you can pay to have a tree planted in an urban area, or if you're out in a more rural area, you know, a portion of land. And I think, you know, there are things you can do to feel engaged if you do are part of an allotment or a bigger process. You know, you could look at some of these methods to get more carbon into your soil yourself. I'm not sure about the second half. I wonder if you guys have a perspective on that.
Yeah, I wasn't so sure about the second part either. Just on the first part, just to say, you know, if you want to kind of engage with this area, we at the Hub are very keen to hear your views and things. So, and you know, we'll be running a number of public facing events over the next few years. So please kind of send us your views on helping to grow the industry as a consumer. Yeah, that's tricky. I'll pass it over.
I'm not the expert on that either. I would say, I think, yeah, getting involved in your local community has so many benefits. So what we do know is that, you know, one kind of activity that you take on related to the climate transition, it opens up sort of your mind and the opportunities that you might feel, and the people in your life will see that. And then this has a domino effect. So, you know, getting involved in conservation activities might be the first step in a much bigger personal journey, which people in your life see and start responding to. That's what we know from research. And yes, GGR is critical, but also 30% of global emissions come from the household, and we have a really long journey to go on shifting those. People are not aware of what it really means and what the changes we're going to have to make actually quite quickly. So I would say that is a very good place to start. But also, you know, I have a somewhat civil society background, and I'm not saying civil society is always perfect, but they do some really important scrutiny. So supporting civil society organisations who are looking at what, you know, how the industry is being regulated or how certain corporations are behaving is important. And also there are, again, you know, the role of like parliamentarians is quite important in this stuff. So find out from your local MP, like, what are they doing to keep an eye on what's going on? What are they doing at the level of the kind of national government? What kind of questions are they asking? That we need to put it on the agenda in a way which is constructive. So we're not saying we can't do this, but in a way which, you know, there is clear mechanisms of scrutiny, and that's just not, it's not, we're not there yet. So we all have a bit of a, those of us who have access to those levers and space and time in our lives, we probably should start kind of doing a bit more.
Thank you for your thoughts on that. And I feel like I may be able to finally answer a question myself. I, as an individual who was interested in engaging more in this industry, joined a small team and we still have a podcast. Not saying that everyone should start a podcast, because then we'd be out of a job. Just that they're just kind of engaging with how you're engaging now as an attendee to the event, you know, tuning in online, reading up about this stuff and taking part in some of the core activities. Like, you don't need to buy a ton of carbon removal or greenhouse gas removal to engage. You can engage through conversation like we're having here. So that's my two cents on that. Do you guys have any particular questions that you're that take your fancy that you'd like to take from this?
Yeah, can I go for Olivia's question? Because I think it's difficult and that's good fun. So Olivia's asking, do you think pushback on climate mitigation tech is a result of lack of understanding of the need for these techs for climate mitigation or genuine concern for potential negative impacts of these techs? Interesting what Olivia has to say on this as well. I find anything that uses this concept of lack of understanding, this kind of like, we've come across this as a kind of knowledge deficit model. If only you just educate people more, if only you just tell people more, then it'll all be fine. And the reality is that there's lots of other factors that play on people's lives that are much more pertinent concerns. And so I personally find a lot of the pushback, or definitely, I mean, I definitely think it is more about concerns. And I think even though, for example, some GGR technologies don't exist today, you can draw a lot of analogies from things that we know exist today, right? So you can ask very good, when people are concerned about biomass energy crops driving deforestation, you say, oh, well, in these scenarios, we protected against that in our model. And it's like, okay, but in the real world, deforestation is being driven by land use. We can see that, we know about that. And also, for example, this point about kind of, you know, you can see if you're going to want to trust the fossil fuel industry to be starting to essentially a repurposed version of the fossil fuel industry to be injecting CO2 deep underground, and you know some of the terrible environmental impacts they've had with oil spills or in countries with less environmental strength to their governance, for example, Nigeria and other places where, you know, we have real life examples of this. And I find that sometimes it's a bit patronising to suggest that the public, very diverse, it's all of us in society, just don't understand. And I'm, you know, as if, oh, just explain more and more and more and then they'll get it. And instead, what they bring is very valid and real life concerns about things that they can quickly and easily draw an analogy between, about trust in like big corporations, your mega projects. You don't, you know, that mega project might be nothing to do with GGR, but you can draw a lot of parallels about and learn from it. And so that's my two cents on Olivia's question there.
Yes, agree. Agree. There's a very genuine concern, and it's based in lived experience, isn't it? And also, who is the proponent of these shift, you know, these technologies as well? We have to look at that. You know, certain organisations, certain governments have progressed us societally in this direction of a climate crisis, and now are saying, oh, well, but we'll just fix it all with science and technology because we're the best countries in the world on science and technology. And I just think there's a trust deficit. So it's perfectly justifiable and understandable that people would have questions about, you know, genuinely currently unproven technologies. Like, what's this going to mean for us? What's this going to mean for some of the most marginalised people in the world? So, yeah.
I just want to take another question. So Steve's question, what's the most exciting or positive GGR development going on right now? Apart from our program, of course, I think the most exciting thing probably that happened in the last few in the last few weeks was you know, the kind of near $1 billion investment from Stripe, which joins many other kind of investments that are going on. So yeah, I was just saying to some people earlier today how it's been quite strange having worked in this field for more than 10 years now, and you know, just very recently feeling that it's kind of you know, the train's kind of left the station. We're kind of, you know, almost trying to catch up with where it's you know, it's gone off into the world now. So we've got to be careful.
On that point about exciting, positive, kind of interesting developments that are going on, has anyone got any, you know, exciting projects that they've recently come across? Is there anything that would be worth highlighting to everyone online as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, I can talk a little bit about what we have planned. I mean, obviously, the GGRA program's wrapped up, and there's tons of exciting stuff that's come out of that. You know, what's exciting from my point of view and my team is that we're going to be looking at, you know, real-world demonstrations of these approaches, which is something that's, you know, up until now, we've been kind of imagining these kind of, what my kind of social science friends like to call socio-technical imaginaries. Just our imagined ways of doing these things. But now it's kind of making that leap into the real world. So I think that's going to be really, really interesting.
I just jump in there to say I find this really funny when we talk about that, because like we've been planting trees for years, people. There's lots of reasons we plant trees. We've been planting trees for decades. So when we say these kind of big statements, there are some forms that are getting to this kind of demonstration phase. Then there's other forms of greenhouse gas removal that are, if you like, well established and are known to work, the land management practices that have been done for a long time. So when I was caught out because I was trying to think of a really good example of a kind of forestry or woodland creation scheme in the UK that was meeting some other communities and livelihoods, and that didn't come to mind as a good example, so that's why I got a bit stuck there. Because for me, I think you've got to remember that some of this GGR is not an abstract new technology that's unknown, it's stuff we know how to do today. There's still things we can get wrong about doing that in terms of land tenure, who owns it, who's benefiting communities, but it isn't, there's no novelty to planting trees. It's about the scale at which we're doing it, who's funding it, who's benefiting it, and is that well designed to meet not just carbon removal but also biodiversity benefits, build resilience, meet other kind of health and well-being, you know, other services provided by that ecosystem. So just to bear that in mind, there's a breadth there, right?
And I think there's like a lot of really cool indigenous techniques that have been practiced for centuries that we can probably, I mean, more and more we're sort of learning from, and they may not be on the scale that we're imagining, but if you think about the Amazon, I mean, now it's a net emitter of carbon, but it was preserved by indigenous communities for like hundreds of years. So there's probably some techniques that we can learn. I mean, there's some countries that are doing massive tree planting schemes, like Pakistan that I've worked in quite a lot, has something called the Million Tree Tsunami. Now, that's great. It's good that the government wanted to invest in that, but there are certain nuances to how you do tree planting, like don't plant all the same trees and destroy the local ecosystem. Not saying that's what's happened, but you know, there are some concerns about that. So I think, yeah, there's probably a lot of really cool stuff going on. We just don't mine that enough and actually learn from what's already been done.
Yep.
Definitely. So we've got about 5 minutes left. This question actually was posed by my co-host, Emily, of the Carbon Removal Show. She unfortunately can't make it today because she has COVID, but she's here in spirit with that question. How hopeful are you about greenhouse gas removal? Starting with maybe Amira at the end, how hopeful are you about greenhouse gas removal?
Can I say a nuanced response to that?
You can say, yes, go on.
I'm a pragmatist and an optimist, and I think that there are, you know, a mix of things we need to do to move things forward, and I think that can be one thing if governed appropriately, but I do think we can't rely on technology. Technology is not going to save us.
Rob, your thoughts?
Am I hopeful?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I am hopeful. I mean, I wouldn't...
That sounds really convincing.
You would hope, given that you're... Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't draw such a strong line between technology and not technology. Mm. You know, from a social science perspective, this is a social construction. I mean, even
okay, somewhat hopeful.
Even social interventions involve technology, whether it's you know, kind of standardized procedures or things like that. Yeah, so no, I am hopeful. I think, you know, we're at a very interesting stage. I think we have broad recognition now that it needs to be done in some form. So now we're just kind of getting down to brass tacks. How are we going to do it? How are we going to do it well?
I think that there's a lot to be hopeful about with GGR. I'm going to echo the need that what you mostly need to do to net zero is reduce your emissions. Like, this is no get out of jail card free. It's something else additional we also have to do. And I think that is something I probably will keep repeating a lot. I think there's a lot of scope to draw on existing understandings and existing knowledge from other things to be able to say, like, this is a better way of doing it, or this is a good enough way of doing it. And there's, I would say, the flip of hopeful, I'm a little bit cautious actually about the sheer volumes of money being thrown at this sector at the rate that it's being thrown at. I'm particularly aware that in the, like, I started my PhD in 2005 and it was all about carbon offsets and it just like, way, and then right, it really really boom bust cycle. And I get a bit worried that everything, potatoes, ice cream, beer, your TV, your internet service provider is promising you that it's net zero by next Tuesday. When I know that most of that money, maybe not next Tuesday, is really realistically being funneled into the tree planting. And I'm a bit worried about some of the pace and some of the over promising. So it, like, you know, so you're hopeful that it's, that there's a lot of enthusiasm in the space, but also a little bit, I don't know, perhaps getting old, a bit cautious and concerned that certain mistakes look like they might play out in terms of kind of, particularly I'm aware of public trust in some of this stuff. And so I suppose, yeah, I'm a bit more, yeah, I probably don't quite answer all of those boxes properly, but a little bit more tempered, because I can also see that some of this overhype and overpromise could get our fingers burnt in terms of kind of trust and publics. And that's problematic for me, because I am aware of the fact that we can't get our emissions all the way down to zero without some GGR, and that you can do GGR well. We know how to do it well. It's just whether the kind of governance and the structures and the institutions and the incentives will work to deliver that or not.
Very excellently summarised. No, excellently summarised. And for what it's worth, I would say that I myself am very hopeful. I've had the pleasure of being able to speak to entrepreneurs, policymakers, scientists, people like yourselves, you know, throughout the last year or so. And it fills me with hope, the amount of smart people and driven and innovative kind of characters that are working on these solutions. So and anyone that's interested, that's online, that wants to engage more with what's happening at the moment, you can learn more about the activities that are being hosted here at the Greenhouse Gas Removal website, CORE, spelled C-O-2-R-E, .org, what is GGR? Any final comments, any final remarks from the panel?
Okay, you're both looking at me. You're going to say something first. I just said something last. I'd say that for those of you who've been online today, turned up, been interested, I would just keep being interested, keep asking questions, and, you know, engage in the ways we talked about in terms of community and other actions. But yeah, keep, yeah, that scrutiny, that questioning, holding to account, engaging with the activities that CORE are going to run in the next few years, you know, so that you get that voice in and talk to others. And I think that, you know, it's very important, attempting to kind of like engage with, you know, the public, 65 million people in the UK, is a big ask. So those who are interested, you know, do engage and have your learn more and get your questions asked and answered.
Couldn't have put it better myself.
There you go.
Final comments?
Yes, I have to plug my organisation, I'm sorry. But mainly because we work with the public on these questions. So www.climateoutreach.org. We have some good studies coming out where we've engaged with different communities and the public on these issues around policies and what they think is fair and what kind of steps they're willing to take as individuals. And so, yeah, check that out. And if you have more questions, do reach out.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for attending, taking time out of your busy evenings, I'm sure. Hopefully keep the conversation going, and goodbye from everyone here. Thanks so much.
Well, what a conversation. First of all, very well done, Tom. I know you didn't have much time to prepare for that, because I was actually supposed to be hosting and then the COVID hit.
I know.
So thank you again for stepping in, and you did a great job.
Thank you. Thank you for the kind words. I'll pat myself on the back. I do feel as though you've done a smashing job, and hope that I did it justice. But yeah, really, really enjoyable. Definitely worthwhile.
So I have a lot of reflections.
Yes.
Listening back to that now. I mean, I had quite a lot of reflections at the time, but I think listening back to it as well is really powerful. And a lot came up when I was listening.
Fire away. I want to hear. Let me be your mirror to reflect on.
All right. Sit back with your cup of tea. We're diving in. So I think one of the important things to sort of launch in with is an acknowledgement that was brought up in this conversation, that it is the beginning of this conversation about carbon removal. We're opening up the space. We do not have all the answers. And we've said this a lot before, Tom, but just framing it that way is always really helpful to me, and I think really helpful for a lot of people. And also reiterates why it's so important to get everyone involved at this stage, because it really is just the beginning.
It's also a nice way to get people in at the start to say, look, well, it's only the beginning of this journey, so why don't you come on board, as opposed to, oh, we're halfway through this process now, so you're a bit of a laggard for coming in now.
Yeah, it can be more open because it's just the beginning. Another point that I wanted to pull out, I suppose it's about public perceptions, really. I think it was Rob who said that question of, you know, who's against nature? and the almost universal understanding that nature equals good. But in fact, that when we're talking about this in this topic, we need to look beyond that, because nature-based solutions may be drawing on nature, but there's so much more to talk about. So since we're talking about nature-based solutions, although this really applies to all of them, I did want to talk about land management. Because when we talk about land, we're not talking about land that's owned by wealthy people, essentially. We're talking about land that's attached to people's livelihoods. And in that way, everything that's been talked about in this event, all of the important pieces about getting people involved and about, you know, having voices be heard and making sure that marginalized communities are there with us and, you know, all of that, so much of it is to do with land. You and I know, Tom, from talking about it last season, that land just comes up time and time again when we're talking about the pros and cons of different techniques. And it almost feels like we're using a euphemism and that it isn't really land that we're talking about. It's like people's livelihoods and it's people's space and homes and all of those things.
Yeah, I've not had that framing before. And now you say it, yeah, it kind of resonates. What else came out for you as a kind of talking point?
Yeah, so something that Nem said, I'm paraphrasing here, but Nem said something along the lines that greenhouse gas removal gives rich people an excuse to keep flying, that you can learn all about what's going on with removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and think, oh, great, now I can fly with a bit of a cleaner conscience because I'll just buy some carbon removal credits. But I suppose the other side of that spectrum for me, which is sort of what Nem alluded to, is that carbon removal for other people, those people who probably aren't flying around the world, it could be life-saving on the other end of that spectrum. There are people in this world currently experiencing really detrimental impacts of climate change, and their lives are at risk. And if we don't deal with that, then more lives are just going to be at risk, increasingly more lives. Unfortunately, that has already started in marginalized communities. For them, carbon removal is actually a game changer on a really like existential level.
There was a question, I think, which came up in the conversation, which was around, can greenhouse gas removal and carbon removal be truly beneficial for these communities? And it's a really difficult question to answer at the moment, at present, because so many of these technologies and initiatives aren't at scale yet. They're not operating at a capacity where we can really see the impact, positive and negative, that they might be having. And, you know, it is a serious question to be asking. Do these initiatives, especially if they're operating in communities in the global south, for example, whether they do actually have a financial and social benefit beyond the climate benefit to these communities? But it's so important to have those conversations now so that we're really cognizant of it when we do get these projects at scale operating in these potential areas.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess that speaks to the fact that it's not just about getting people involved in the conversation. It's about actually making it fair and equitable across the board. You know, we have to make the fairness and the equity tangible and not just about the conversation and voices being heard. It has to, yeah, they have to walk the walk as well as talking the talk.
Yeah, it feels as though over the last few episodes, we've gone on this little arc, as it were, where we start out talking about getting people to agree with the science and getting people on side and talking to them about all the good that this carbon removal industry can have. And then we've kind of shifted more in this episode and over the last couple of episodes into, it kind of feels as though, in a way, carbon removal as an industry is inevitable. The policy is starting to come, perhaps in certain countries. The initiatives are starting. There seems to be that there's the relevant demand signals. So it's kind of shifting away from whether it's going to happen or not to it is kind of happening. And then it's more a conversation around, is this going to be happening in the right way? How do you get the right stakeholders to help this develop in the best way possible? And what effect will those voices have on how the industry develops?
Yeah, I think you're right, Tom, because it's not just about working with diverse peoples because it's like right and it's just and it's, you know, an equitable way of doing things. Of course, that is so important and we have to like live that way. But it also makes sense in terms of making effective, durable projects. You know, this event was called Getting It Right for People and Planet. And it feels like we can do all the work in the world to get it right for the planet, which is great and obviously super important. But if it's not right for people, then who's to say that it's going to last, you know, or that it's going to be fully integrated within these settings, community, social, governmental settings that it needs to be integrated into. It just makes sense to get it right for people and planet and to not prioritize one over the other. They have to really be aligned. I want to hear your personal reflections. What was it like to be there at the event and have this panel, you know, share their expertise and to engage with the audience? And also, what was it like listening back with a bit of hindsight and sort of experiencing it all over again?
Yeah, just a personal reflection on that is that I felt very honored to be up there as a non-expert myself, in that I've only recently come into this space in the last 2 years. I don't have a degree and a deeply scientific background in this space. So felt very honored to be part of that. I felt hopeful, like I said, felt hopeful coming off the back of that conversation, the fact that we've got those three different types of speakers up on stage speaking about this sort of stuff, and hopeful of the fact that there were so many questions. I mean, I don't think I've been part of an event, let alone sat on a panel where there'd been so many questions fired my way. It was a real challenge to kind of pick the ones that were most relevant at the time. And so thanks to everyone that did listen in and that asked those questions.
So here's my final question for you. As we move on with this season and we continue to have conversations like this, what little teasers from this event do you think we'll be exploring more as we move forward? What do you sort of want to draw out in the next conversations and in future episodes?
I think firstly, very keen to see and speak to people that are doing stuff on the ground, as it were. Lots of people that we spoke to in season one, they have these concepts and they have these smaller projects and these tests that they're doing. I'm really keen to get out there and see what's happening at a bit more scale and the challenges that businesses are facing with regards to that. I think also, yeah, diving more into that conversation around getting it right for people and planet and making sure that we're not just getting people to agree that carbon removal is good. Well done. Great job. You guys should definitely do that. Getting people to actually chip in with their opinions and bring their insights from different industries. And then also see what else is happening, I guess, to drive the markets forward, to drive carbon removal further. The demand signals that are happening, seeing who's actually buying this stuff. Because I know we've spoken about it a lot, like there's demand and things like that, but like who's actually buying this beyond the big kind of stripes of the world, the Shopify's, the Microsoft's.
Nice. Yeah, exciting stuff. For me, I think there's just so much that's come out of this whole core event from both this episode and the previous episode that are like little nuggets that are going to stay with us no matter what we're having a conversation about specifically. You know, this is just a great framing for the whole development of the industry, I think. And then we now have that as, I guess, an ingredient to put into these conversations, which I really like. Okay, Tom, because I know that you love giving away juicy spoilers to our listeners so much, I will gift to you the honor of sharing with our listeners what's coming up next time. And it's big, listeners, it's big this time.
Oh yeah.
Big news.
It's big. Yeah, I'm excited. We've been holding it. It feels like I've been holding it in for so long. God, it's exciting to tell you guys. We, the Little Old Carbon Removal Show, we are off to the country of Iceland.
We're going to Iceland.
Oh yeah. And you might ask why. Well, I will tell you why. They have some incredibly exciting climate initiatives, but also more specifically carbon removal initiatives that are going on in Iceland right now. So we are going to go and we're going to speak to people that are on the ground, building these projects, launching these sites. Cannot wait to talk a bit more about that with you all. We were also invited to take part in an innovation week where there's going to be all sorts of conversations around climate happening as well. And who doesn't want to go to Iceland?
No one I know. If you've never been and never even thought you wanted to go, you have to listen to these episodes because I get the feeling it's going to make you want to go to Iceland.
Definitely.
In the meantime, if you've got time on your hands, go back, listen to some episodes from season one and the beginning of season two. You can find them all wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at RestoredCC or LinkedIn, The Carbon Removal Show. Give us a rate and a review, and we'll speak to you next time.
Sayonara.
Bye-bye.
Thanks to everyone who makes this show possible.
Our researcher and fact-checker, Henry Irvine.
Our composer, Sam Carter.
Our graphic designer, Reke Campbell.
Our content manager, Jordan Brooks.
Our guest booker, Anna DeWolf Evans.
Our editor, Mercy Barno.
Our producer, Ben Weaver Hinks.
Our project manager, Patrick Carter.
And our executive producer, Sam Floyd.
Co-fruition.